session number 18455, reel 3.
Ron Hedges, reel 3.
Yeah, well, anyway, as I say, one chap called Grimwood, he'd lost his eye, and him with the other were whipped off to hospital somewhere. I never saw them no more. In fact, I didn't see Grimwood until just a few years ago. And carried on from there with a few more XBI. Some of them I don't like to talk about, actually. But we had a lot of good times. Had a lot of laughs. You had to laugh at these sort of things. And if he hadn't done it, he'd gone mad. I remember one experience we had. We'd been to up to one of the companies to blow something or other up, I think, three of us. And everywhere we used to go, we used to have to take a mess tin with us and a pot, plus rifle ammunition, explosive, detonated, all this sort of thing. And because we never knew when we were going to get back, so we had to scrounge our meals when we were out in different companies. And anyway, we'd been to blow something or other up. And coming back, we were coming across this paddy field at bottom of the hills. And it was in view of the Chinese, actually. And as we came across, they started firing at us. And we dropped down at the back of a little hillock in this paddy field to take cover. And, of course, we couldn't see where the Chinese were, but they could see us. And every time we moved to get away from this hillock, they fired at us. And we were pinned down until it got dark. And what the amusing thing was that we were just laid there. We realised we couldn't get away until it got dark, so we just laid there. And in Korea there were some massive grey ants, they're enormous things. And some of these got me messed in, and I started knocking them together. And in the end, these ants started fighting like dogs, and you could actually hear them squeaking. I get annoyed, you know, it must have vibrated around the mess tins, I suppose, and you could hear these ants squeaking. It's absolutely amazing. And that kept us entertained until it got dark, and that's when we got away. Another amusing incident was we came out of the line once, and of course we were all looking scruffy, dirty, one thing or another. And the RS, as we marched back towards the headquarters there, the RSM was there waiting for us. The RSM's all pressed up, looking all smart and things. And he halted our platoon there and said, "Wait there." Off he went. And he came back and he handed me two sets of hair clippers and a comb. And he said, "Cut the hair." And I had to go through the platoon cutting the hair. Well, I never could do it in my life. So I had my week and cuts and God only knows what cuts. It was quite a laugh, really. Especially when our officer wanted his cutting, and he'd ginger hair, and kept saying, just take a bit, don't cut too high, and anyway, I went right over the top, and he looked all right, sight. But, yeah, it broke a bit of silence up, did that, cutting hair. Also up when I was up there, when the battalion had come out of the line there, I had to go back in. To work with Australians, also at different times, I remember New Zealanders, Canadians. We got around a bit in the salt pioneers and different. Only trouble was we were sometimes back up the line when the battalion was out. So we probably got more than a share, you know, a fair share. It was just like Second World War, the trenches. They had to be spotlessly clean, no pavement. Well, it was a common sense anyway. No rubbish about and all this sort of thing. They were swept out and goodness only knows what, blanco, whitewash, you name it. But Colonel Jeffries was an experienced soldier. And where we went on to positions where the trenches were shallow, he insisted they were dug to at least 6 foot. And they were dug. And I think the Durhams were good at this digging trenches anyway. But I think in the long run it saved a lot of lives, because when we were getting shelled and this sort of thing, as many a time men could get in the bottom of a trench and they'd come out all right, whereas they'd been in shallow trenches, it'd have been all over. I remember getting badly shelled one night when we were up on, I think the battalion was on top of 355, I believe it was, and we were down at the bottom on hill on our own, and next to us was the South Korean soldier, and the Chinese put an attack into them, and I was on stag during the night then with another chap called Melvin Gill, and these shells started coming in. So he went round to the back of the hill, reverse slopes, to get men out, and they all came out, got into the fighting trenches at the front. And he couldn't get back to me because the shelling had got that bad. And he finished up at the other end of the hill. And I got one of these Korean soldiers that are attached to us called Catcombs. And we were in the bottom of this drain gun pit. And he was absolutely petrified. Well, I was frightened, but he was absolutely petrified. And I realised, you know, I was on my own. So I got the brain gun down in the bottom of the pit, and got hand grenades out of boxes, got them all lined up, because I knew very well wherever the shells were coming through, Chinese weren't going to come. And you could hear them down in the bottom of our hill there, and shouting and blowing bugles and goodness only knows what. And the barrage lifted, and for some reason they didn't come. And I never understand it. I think they must realise they're going up the wrong hill or something. And they must have gone up to the South Korean position. But our trenches were badly blown in. And one of the Koreans was badly wounded across the stomach and chest. And the lad dragged him round to the command post. And we spent a few days after that digging the trenches out. I know a mate of mine, he was doing... wireless operator in a command post, and after a while and the shelling had been going on, he came round with a flask of coffee for me. That was John Blackburn. And just as he went to unscrew this here coffee or flask, a shell dropped right on the edge of the trench, and there was a great pine tree there, and that blew it straight out the ground. And when I looked, John Blackburn, he disappeared, and I thought he'd been blown to bits, but actually it had blown him up the trench. And he crawled back down again, cursing and swearing, because it had demolished the flask. But, I think we're laughing about it, actually. I think, don't know, laughing hilarious or laughing with fear, I think. But I know in the morning, when I looked there where we'd been in that brain gun pit, this here Korean, he'd been that petrified, he'd been clawing at the sandbags, and he'd actually dug through the sandbags into the sand, or into whatever was in the sandbag. No joke to be shelled. No joke at all.
What did you think of the enemy?
Didn't really think. I don't know. I didn't really think much of. I don't know really. I did feel. I used to feel sorry for them when we used to be on top of them hills. And they used to come in, planes used to come in and drop napalm on them. And I really felt sorry for them fellas. I thought, well, you know, they're just the same as us. And there's no escaping napalm. If that drops anywhere near you, the amount will say you're dead. And if you're not dead, you'll want to be. Because it just explodes and comes down like liquid straight into the trenches. And there's no escaping. I can only be thankful that the Chinese never napalmed us. But at that time I used to feel really sorry for them fellas. And another thing I was sorry for was, and it's been in my mind for years really, is that there were some tunnels across in front of one of our positions that they were using. And I think there were five of these tunnels. And I tried bombing them and tried shelling them. And from the position they were in, they couldn't do anything with them. But they knew the Chinese were using them, so somebody decided that they'd have to be blown up manually. And I got allocated one of these tunnels. And we went out early that night, over the top. The idea was to get down there before the Chinese come out or whatever. And over the top early, down onto where these tunnels were. And we knew which ones we were going into. And I went into mine. Well, I crept into it. And I only got in a few yards. And it was stacked up with ammunition. So I put my explosive in amongst this air ammunition and run a wire out. And waited a few of the lads to come out and put the wires together on electric explode and blew the lot up. And I've often wondered just how many men were in there, you know, whether there were some, a lot, a few, whatever. But whoever were in there, they were buried alive, they'd never get out. It went up with that bigger explosion. And I'm the sort of things about you think of after. You didn't think of it at the time. You're only thinking of saving your own skin, I suppose, at the time. It's a matter of he that shoots first lives and that sort of thing.
What exactly was this tunnel?
Well, I don't really. Well, you see, where we had trenches, and then we'd dig into the side of the trench and erect some sort of a dugout hutch, as they call them. These fellows used to dig tunnels into the hillsides, and they're going, well, I don't know how far they used to go in. I suppose in the same sort of way what the Germans used to dig into the, in on the Somme, where they used to dig long tunnels and live in them. And that's what these Chinese apparently done. So at the time, it was a matter of get there before they came out. In fact, the Durham Light Infantry, they dominated No Man's Land, no doubt about that. Colonel Jeffries made sure that patrols were out and they contained the Chinese. The Chinese weren't allowed to make preparations to attack or anything like that because our men were always down there and they could hear them moving about. And as soon as the movement, they brought the artillery in and they were, and the Chinese were shelled. And there's no, you know, there wasn't a lot of chance of them massing. When the Americans took over from us, at one time. They just allowed the Chinese to take over, and when we come back in, it all had to be altered. But that was all down to Colonel Jeffries, his planning. Good fella.
What did you think about the Allied troops? You've already mentioned the Australians, but the other Allied troops.
Well, we were in the Commonwealth Division, so really we only came up about, you know, with the Australians. As I say, the Australians were great. New Zealanders and Canadians. Canadians, well, some of that I'd never seen such big men in my life. They were like man mountains. When we got out there, the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry and the Vandoos. And they told me half these Vandoos were lumberjacks or something like that in Canada, and they were massive men. I've never seen nothing like it. They were massive. But these Australians, they're all volunteers. In fact, a lot of the Australians were British. At that time, you could volunteer and join the Australian Army because it's a lot better pay than ours, and that's what a lot of people done. So a lot of them were actually English, Scottish or whatever. But they were a great set of fellows. New Zealanders. They were mostly gunners, and sometimes we had the New Zealand guns at the back of us, sometimes Royal Artillery. But there's a lot of rivalry between the Australians and the New Zealanders. And times when I've been with the New Zealanders, if you got in a lorry and you were going somewhere to pick something up or whatever, the Aussies would jump in and they'd also get a barrel of water or a load of stones, grass sods, that sort of thing. And as the lorry went along, they'd be looking for New Zealanders and they'd chuck water at them, throw grass sods at them and all sorts. And it was all, there was nothing vicious in it. It's just the way they were. It was just rivalry and they enjoyed it. The New Zealanders do the same to the Australians. They were great, you know, great. The Australians, they'd salute their officer in the morning, and that'd be it for the day. Now, we were saluting up and down whenever you saw one move. And I was once with an Australian there, or two Australians, and we were going somewhere, but And this lorry stopped, and there was an English officer there. Wasn't one of ours, I don't know. And he said something to this Australian, and the Australian answered him back. And he said, don't you know I'm an officer? And the Australian said, yeah, you're a pommy. And he says, don't you know that you salute officers? And he says, I saluted mine this morning. And he said, but, you know, it's afternoon or whatever, but, you know, this Australian, he wouldn't salute this officer. No way, no. And the officer said, right, I'll take your name and number and report you. And the Australian said, no, you won't. And he wouldn't show him, wouldn't give him his number, wouldn't show him his pay book. And the officer, in the end, you know, he realised he couldn't do nothing with him. And that was it. But that was the way the Australians were. They called their officer skipper. And the officer would drink with them and whatever. And but as soon as the officer gave an order, that was it. It was carried out. And the officers treated their soldiers like men. Where our army, the men were treated like, in my opinion, like second-class children. Like Australians, they could drink anything they wanted. But in the British Army, other ranks weren't allowed spirits. Not that you could afford it anyway. But in the NAFI, they weren't allowed spirits. You were only allowed beer. A little silly thing like that. It was a completely different army. Really good, though.
Did you see anything of the civilian population?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, we didn't in the line, of course, because there was no there were no civilians anywhere near the front line. But odd times when we'd go back and fetch supplies and one thing and another, you to see them. And it was absolutely pathetic. And what always got me, there was thousands, literally thousands of children wandering all up and down the hills. And you'd see little kids of, I don't know, 7, 8, 9, and they'd be carrying their brothers or sisters on the backs. And they were orphans. They'd just been left abandoned, or the parents had been killed and this sort of thing. And they just wandered about. And they even used to wander up to the back of the front line because they were looking for food and this sort of thing. We used to give them what we, you know, what we could, chocolate, their own food and this sort of thing. And they had some of the older ones used to work in the cookhouses and things like that. And in fact, a lot of them, I should imagine, it saved their lives working in the British Army cookhouses, or Americans for that matter as well, or whoever. But it was absolutely, it was terrible to see them. It really was that. I wondered for years, you know, what could have happened to all these orphans that wandered about. And I do know after the war that the orphanages were set up for them. It was awful. Well, that's what you get in war.
How did you come to leave Korea?
Well, we were there when it finished. And the talks had been going on at Panmunjom all the time we've been there. And in fact, at night, there was a searchlight at Panmunjom that pointed straight up in the air, and that was on every night. And I think that was there so that where these talks were being held wasn't shell bombed and whatever. But from our position where we were, we could always see this searchlight. And eventually, of course, the ceasefire was declared. It had come on 10 o'clock that particular night. And sure enough, it happened. And it was absolutely unbelievable that all of a sudden the shelling and explosions, and they just finished. And it was only then you realised that all that time you were there, you were continually listening for a shell coming in, or a bomb or whatever. You know, you're continually listening, so you could dive on the floor or out of the way. And all of a sudden when it stopped, it was absolutely eerie and unbelievable. You couldn't imagine the difference. And that was it. And then it was, they started removing ammunition, everything out the front line, and had to move back to the demarcation line.
So you didn't have any fraternisation with the enemy?
Oh, no. Only ever saw them from a distance. saw them at night. In fact, I laid in the grass one night when the patrol walked past about 10 yards away, I suppose. They had a dog with them. And I heard them coming because I could hear the radio. And I got down in some grass. Well, there's some more beside me, of course. And they walked past, and I thought I'd hear my heart beating because I could hear it beating. And I'd bring gun there, pointing at them, but there were a lot more of them than what there was of us, so it paid to keep quiet while the gun passed. Apart from that sort of thing, I never saw them.
How did you actually physically leave Korea?
How did we leave?
Yes.
Well, after the demarcation line was set up and all that sort of thing, I believe our CO volunteered to stay on a few weeks to help to do that, set it all up. And eventually we were shipped back down to Busan and onto the Empire Orwell. And then I went to Egypt.
How do you feel now about having served in the Korean War?
Well, it's something that you never forget, really. Little things forever triggering it off in your mind. You try to forget it sort of thing, but you just can't. You're something that's always there. And I suppose in a way I'm glad to have had the experience. Well, not glad to have had the experience, but I was glad to be in the Durhams anyway. They were a good set, really, and a good set of lads. But it's something you never forget. You can't forget it.
Did your army experience leave any changes on you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I was a completely different person when I came back. That's my wife, she can tell you. I only know from my side, but looking from her side,
what changes that it brought about?
I couldn't stand any sort of, how can you put it, authority, I think. I'd had enough of it. Anybody that tried to sort of impose a will on me, I just couldn't stand it. So I finished up getting into all sorts of situations. I went back to work where I used to work. And I realised that I'd have to have something to replace what I'd had in the army. And,
you mean it brought you into conflict with your employers?
So I packed up where I work and went in the coal mine. And there you got the same or similar sort of comradeship that they had in the army.
But you still had an employer in the coal mine?
Oh, yeah, but it was a different situation. Everybody was responsible for their own safety, and you were responsible for your workmates' safety. And there was a lot of comradeship there. And eventually, I was getting on when I went down the coal mine, and I had to work my way up from the bottom, as you might say. And I went from doing menial jobs to working on the coal face. And then I went to technical college for about 6 months and got the qualifications as a deputy. And I went deputy. And I enjoyed it. And there again, when I was deputy, I was with explosive again.
One thing I don't quite understand is if you found the army authority so oppressive, why is it that you're so proud of having been in the DLI?
Difficult to explain, really. But there were a lot of these, mostly lads were from Durham. And the Durham people are a good set of people. And there was a lot of tradition attached to the Durham Light Infantry that didn't apply to ordinary infantry regiments. Like, everything was green, a green berry. Even when we went to Egypt, we were supplied with khaki drill uniform in Egypt, but we still wore the green berry, and the ankle putties were green. The blanco belts was green. And Colonel Jeffries was a real traditionary sort of a fella, and he kept the tradition of the Durham Light Infantry alive. And so we stood out from other troops, really. Where other troops, if they were in Culham and they were going to move off, they get orders such as attention, slope arms, quick march, and all this sort of thing. Whereas the Durhams would just get one order, quick march from their T's, and off they went. It was completely different from other regiments, that was a thing. And after all, the light infantry were actually the forerunners of such as the commandos, SAS and all this sort of thing, because they started during the American Wars as skirmishers. In fact, they were the first regiments in British Army to wear any kind of camouflage, where they went to green. There's a lot of tradition to be proud of, I suppose. And that was one thing I admired about it.